Morning. We have our second case today, 02-3293, GPS, Inc. v. Town of St. Germain. Arguing on behalf of GPS, Inc. is James Friedman. Let me just tick off the how this time is divided so we're sure we have it correct. Attorney O'Connor, 12.5 for the Town of St. Germain. William White, 7.5 for the amicus in the local government section. Richard Norting, 10 minutes for the amicus Wisconsin County Association. And then 5 minutes for Mr. Friedman in rebuttal. Okay. Let us proceed. Mr. Friedman.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the Court, I'm James Friedman of La Follette, Godfrey & Kahn. Along with my colleagues, Robert Dreps and Jennifer Peterson, I represent the petitioner in this case, GPS, Inc. I note that Glenn Schiffman, the president of GPS, also is in attendance in the courtroom today. The Wisconsin legislature mandated that the records of a town zoning board of appeals be opened for public inspection. This court mandated that the proceedings of those boards, including their deliberations, are open to the public. But the town board here tries to use the attorney-client privilege as a shield to close those records and render meaningless those proceedings. The attorney-client privilege, this court has held, is a narrow one. It cannot overcome the legislative and judicial mandates of openness at issue in this case. The court should reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals. As in most open records cases, the facts here never have been in dispute, but they are of some interest. On November 1st of 1999, GPS applied for a zoning permit to build a single-family residence on a piece of property in the town of St. Germain. That permit was denied because of an ordinance requiring a 75-foot setback from the town roads, and that was essentially impossible for a home on this particular lot. GPS requested a variance from the Town of St. Germain Zoning Board of Appeals. That board held a hearing on December 15th of 1999. At that hearing, there was some testimony, but the board did not deliberate and did not decide the variance request. On January 10th of 2000, there was a second hearing. Again, this time there was no testimony. There was no discussion by the board. There was no deliberations by the board. The board simply received a packet. Each member reviewed that packet for a few minutes, and then they voted to deny the variance request. There are essentially three records at issue in this case.
Counsel, can I just ask, I think this is the proper time to do it since you've sequentially gone through this. So there was a board, there was a decision, and why wasn't there a certiorari motion, that motion for cert? In other words, the board acted supposedly arbitrary in a capricious manner. Wouldn't that have been an opportunity to do that? Or maybe, I don't know if you were counsel, and I'm just asking that for my own edification.
Certainly, Justice Wilcox, and I was not counsel at the time. My client had a choice. They could have sought certiorari review of the board's decision. They chose not to. What they decided to do instead was to try to find out what really happened. What was that process that was so bizarre, at least in their eyes? And so they made an open records request.
Wouldn't they have been able to at least explore that under that motion, a writ of cert, and then they would have been entitled to some of the very things that you're talking about here, as far as what actions the board took, whether they were arbitrary, and would have been able to go back in and look at what the board had done.
Justice Wilcox, since we didn't go down that path, it's hard to say. My sense would be that if a certiorari petition were filed challenging the board's conduct, the board undoubtedly would have again said, attorney-client privilege, you can't have these through the discovery process. But that's just a guess.
Mr. Friedman, let me ask you this. When I got done reading your brief in this particular case, I wondered if there was ever a situation where the attorney-client privilege would apply. In other words, it seemed to me that in your brief you were taking a very broad position in terms of using the statutory provisions in regard to open records and in regard to open proceedings. And I was troubled by whether or not you feel there is any limit using 90503. Is there anything that you feel is opened, or I shouldn't say open, I should say closed, so that there could be consultation with counsel and it wouldn't be open to the general public?
Absolutely, Justice Crooks. There are different situations, different types of proceedings where that would be the case, and the perfect example, of course, would be litigation, pending or threatened litigation against the board. For example, an employee of the board sues them for sexual harassment. Clearly, they can consult with an attorney in private to discuss strategy in that case. Beyond that, though, I think there are some records that essentially were created at least by individual members of the board, which would not necessarily be subject to the mandate in Chapter 62. And I would use as an example there if individual board members took notes during the hearing. I don't think those necessarily would be subject to the mandate of that statute, because those wouldn't be the examinations of the board, the official actions of the board, the proceedings of the board. So we're not seeing every scrap of paper. And as I said, under the situation of litigation pending or threatened, we would not suggest that the privilege has been abrogated by the legislature.
Well, you were about to tell us about the three documents are at issue here. Now, as I understand it, one of those documents is a letter from the chairman to the attorney. The second is a letter from the attorney to the chairman. Aren't those traditionally the kinds of things that would be covered by 90503, by the attorney-client privilege?
Justice Crooks, if you don't mind, I'd answer that in two ways, and the first one will be the more direct one. Our argument here is that both by statute and by this court's mandate in the Hodge versus Town of Turtle Lake case, these records and these proceedings are transparent. You can't have secrecy. It doesn't matter whether you invite the attorney along or communicate with an attorney. And I'll get to that. But more directly, we would also suggest, and we did put this in our briefs, I think at each level, that these particular records, while in form were between an attorney and a client, are not the types of records that normally would be subject to that privilege that this court has said time and again is a narrow privilege. It's a privilege that gets in the way of seeking the truth. With respect to the latter two documents, and you mentioned one, the memorandum from the counsel, which summarizes in very broad legal terms, in very broad general terms, I should say, the law that applies to a zoning variance in Wisconsin.
Counselor, just let me interrupt you for a minute before you go on. That's the December 14th memo. Is that the one you're talking about?
Yes, I believe that's right.
Okay, all right, go ahead. I just want to be sure we're on the same page.
Right, and then the third of the records is similarly from outside counsel to the board chair. That one essentially is a cover letter in which, this is a direct quote, "Enclosed, please find various documents that we propose will constitute the records of the board's decision," end quote. That cover letter then goes on to, again, in very general terms, explain the process that the board should use. And what we're suggesting is a general recitation of the law, whether with respect to process or substance, is not privileged. That is just a summary of legal principles. The first, and in fact, as the court knows, if it's not from the client to the attorney, if it's vice versa, the question becomes, does it incorporate the confidential communications of the client? And I would suggest that both of those in almost no way do incorporate the confidential communications of the client. The third record in particular, there's really nothing in there that would incorporate that. The second one, you could say, well, some of the facts applied by the attorney to the law maybe came from the first record, which is the handwritten summary of the underlying facts from the town chair. Now, that record, again, you're talking about, it's about a paragraph summary of facts everyone knows. Where's the property located? Things like that. Very public information. And then a request for legal analysis. And we quoted a Minnesota Supreme Court decision in our briefs, which I think is apposite in this case. And what the Minnesota court said is that documents like that, and if I can quickly find the quote, the attorney-client exception discussed herein would almost never extend to the mere request for general legal advice or opinion by a public body in its capacity as a public agency. And I think that would apply here. So a direct answer to your question, Justice Crooks, is that even applying the attorney-client privilege, even presuming that there can be a privilege under these circumstances, we still think these records should be made public. But our primary argument is that the legislature and this court have both said the proceedings and the records of these types of bodies, these quasi-judicial bodies that are not involved in an adjudicative process in an adversarial process, are always open.
Counsel, let me ask you a question. Can a document that would start out as protected by attorney-client privilege when given to a client change its protected status depending on the use the client makes of the document?
Justice Rogenczyk, I'm not sure if I can think of an example where that would happen, and certainly in this case, you know, the whole proceeding here is about a variance request on a zoning decision, and I don't think there's, at least in this circumstance, and with a zoning board of appeals, I don't see how that could happen. They have a very limited statutory duty. Essentially, there are three things that they can look at and review.
I don't want to look at that statute. I want to look at 90503, the attorney-client privilege statute. Because for me, the rub comes between that statute and the board's obligation under Chapter 62 to have open deliberations. And I have the documents out of the record that you spoke of, which is why I wanted to pin you down to be sure you and I were both looking at exactly the same things. And as I look at them, you know, and as I look at your arguments in your brief that essentially these documents constituted the board's deliberation, that was really the genesis of my question. Because most of the case law generally starts out with, well, if it's given from an attorney to a client, the question is, was it given in a confidential manner? Because every communication between an attorney and a client is not. And if it was initially given that way, can the client then use it in such a way that the confidentiality is lost? I'm just trying to analyze how what you're looking for might fit in between the obligations that I see under those two statutes.
Well, our argument, Justice Rogenczyk, is that based on the legislative mandate in Chapter 62 and based on this court's mandate in Hodge, that these zoning boards of appeal and similar quasi-judicial bodies know going in. They can't have confidential communications with their attorney about the substance of variance requests, the substance of these zoning decisions. And so they can stamp confidential on it, as they did in two of the three documents in this case, but it never can be because it is always either going to be part of the examination by the board of the variance request, I'm using the statutory term, or part of the other official actions of the board, again using the statutory terminology.
Also, aren't you really concerned about the procedure, how they conducted themselves? In other words, I can readily see that there would be some concern when the board sat there in silence, looked at the documents, there wasn't any discussion, and then later on you get a ruling. What about where the counsel meets with someone and gets a, they're not in the presence, in other words, or before it starts? Are you saying that you're entitled to all of those documents also?
Well, I think the statute,
I made myself clear. In other words, this type of proceeding, I think that I'll just speak, it is concerning about the conduct. But what about where there's a discussion with the attorney in a room before it starts?
Justice Wilcox, I think you'd have to look at the language of the statute and then this court's decision in Hodge. Certainly Hodge applies here only with respect to the deliberative process. That was the question. And it is part of our argument, as Justice Rogenczyk indicated, that this is part and parcel to the deliberations. With respect to the statute, there are essentially three types of records that are always public records, and those are minutes of the proceedings. And if you look at some of the statutes that were cited by one of the amici in this case, other statutes talk about the proceedings having to be published and being public. So those are the votes, the minutes of what happened at the meeting. Number two, though, it says records of its examinations, in other words, the examinations of a variance request, or there are other similar proceedings that these boards handle, and finally, other official actions. And I think when you take minutes of the proceedings, examinations, other official actions, and add them together, you're getting a pretty broad spectrum. So with respect to documents that were produced outside of the context of a variance proceeding like this, I don't have an answer to that, and I don't know that the statute necessarily addresses it. But once they start this process, I mean, these were not just scribblings. Clearly, Chairman Sharon either had implicit or explicit authority from the board to go to Mr. O'Connor to elicit his input to help them as they examined this variance request. And that's our argument here.
Delegation of power to Mr. O'Connor?
Well, to be honest with you, Chief Justice, and I think this answers Justice Wilcox's question as well, we just don't know. And that's why my client wanted the records. They could have challenged the process. They didn't do that. Instead, what they did was to try to find out what the process was, and that's why we're here. And we're not here on a due process challenge, but the point is they have a right to know what the process is. The legislature has said that process should be open to all, and in this case, it just plain wasn't. The statute is unique. It's not like those statutes pointed out for city councils, town boards in general. Those are not quasi-judicial bodies, and those statutes are much narrower. The proceedings have to be published and are open. It doesn't talk about examinations, other official actions. Those are very different. Here, the legislature mandated that all three of those types of records are open, and as I said, we have a hard time finding a record with respect to a variance proceeding, except maybe, again, the scribblings of individual members, that wouldn't constitute either the proceedings or the examinations, the record of the examinations, or the record of official actions. That's what we have in this case. And that absolute transparency that was mandated by the legislature, both for the meetings and for the records, is just plain sound public policy. Zoning appeals boards are quasi-judicial bodies. They make critical decisions about real property, including homes affecting real people in Wisconsin. It is absolutely essential that the public have the utmost confidence in those boards, and secrecy undermines that confidence, as it clearly has done in this case. GPS simply does not know what process was used to decide its variance request and prohibit it from building a house on that property. As we pointed out, courts can rely on outside expert advice. So can a Board of Zoning Appeals. They absolutely should seek legal counsel in these situations. It's the right thing to do. But like courts, they can't do it outside of the public eye. They must do it in front of the public. They can't hide behind the attorney-client privilege. As I mentioned in Hodge versus Town of Turtle Lake in 1993, this court declared that zoning boards must deliberate in open session. The Town of St. Germain Zoning Board of Appeals did not. Instead, it substituted written communications with its council for open deliberations. That's all there is. Those communications are tantamount to the board's deliberations. They do what you would do when deliberating. We quoted dictionaries on the definition of deliberation, and it includes talking about what are the facts underlying the problem. What's the legal analysis? That's what these records are. They are the deliberations. The board didn't do it verbally. The board cannot arrogantly ignore this court's mandate in Hodge by doing in writing what it could not do face-to-face. The law would not have allowed these discussions to take place in person behind closed doors. That the exact same discussion took place through the mail does not justify keeping it secret. The town board, throughout its briefing, refers to the records as confidential communications. But that begs the question. did the town board have the authority to communicate in confidence with it, with its outside counsel regarding the substance of a variance request? The legislature and this court say no. But as I mentioned before, even if the answer to that first question were otherwise, we believe these records still would not be subject to the attorney-client privilege and would be subject to the openness requirement in the open records law. The attorney-client privilege, as this court has held, must be narrowly construed because it is an obstacle to the investigation of the truth. Now, the open records law, on the other hand, is to be broadly interpreted for openness. Section 19.31 of the statute says sections 19.32 to 19.37 shall be construed in every instance with a presumption of complete public access consistent with the conduct of governmental business. The denial of public access generally is contrary to the public interest, and only in an exceptional case may access be denied. This is not an exceptional case. Moreover, the legislative
aren't you stuck when you get into Chapter 19 with deciding whether these are attorney-client privileged anyway, because Chapter 19 accepts the requirement to provide documents to those areas where the statutes provide you don't have to provide them? So, I mean, you're still back to the same place, aren't you?
Well, Justice Rogosek, that's absolutely right. And we freely acknowledge that there are circumstances where certain governmental bodies need and can apply the attorney-client privilege.
Right. And so if these are privileged, you're stuck. And if these are not privileged, they're stuck, right?
Well, I guess that's the question that's before the court today, Justice Rogosek. Absolutely. What we're suggesting is these documents, the entire proceeding, whether it be verbal or whether it be written, must be open. That's what the legislature said. And this court essentially said that about deliberations in Hodge.
I have a question for you. Let's take another kind of entity, like a city council, which has a full-time city attorney, right? Milwaukee, Madison, maybe others. City attorney sits there. City attorney can give them advice on the floor. And the city council proceedings have to be open, right?
Subject to Section 19.85 sub 1, which lists situations where you can go behind closed doors, one of which is to confer with counsel about pending or threatened litigation.
So you say that doesn't apply here?
No, there is no litigation. This is not an adversary proceeding.
So we're just going to do the validity of a proposed ordinance, right? And they're going to ask counsel what she thinks, right? That should be open?
Yes, Your Honor, and again, I would say subject to 19.85 sub 1, because if this ordinance, with respect to an ordinance, I think the answer is going to be yes, virtually absolutely.
Because it's legislative?
It's legislative. It's not going to fit within one of the exceptions under the statute, and there's not a mandate of openness with respect to a city council as there is in Chapter 62 with respect to a zoning board of appeals.
Zoning board of appeals, legislative or judicial, quasi-legislative or quasi-judicial?
It is quasi-judicial. That's the decision that this court came to in the Hodge case, and I think it's clearly that way. It's making decisions rather than legislating. It's making decisions about individual rights rather than legislating generally.
And you're not going to give it counsel?
No, we absolutely think that it should have counsel.
But open?
Absolutely. What facts they relied on in this case, the town board relied on, and what the law is, everyone should know that. How can you have confidence that the board did the right thing if they won't tell you what facts they relied on or what law they relied on? They wouldn't even tell us what process they intended to use. At first, they withheld from my client what process they were going to use to notice the meetings, but then they decided that one probably should be open. That's the problem here. The problem is not simply that they used counsel, it's that they used counsel to shield information that must be public if the public can have confidence in this quasi-judicial body.
Well, go ahead.
Mr. Friedman, I was just thinking about the amicus briefs in this case. They seem to take the position that if we buy your argument, if we go along with your argument, that it's going to greatly restrict the ability of public bodies to consult with counsel. Do you have any response to that?
Yeah, I just don't think that's the case, Justice Crooks. There is a specific statute that is unique to, it's really zoning boards, it's county boards of adjustment that do the same thing, to quasi-legislative bodies, bodies with powers like you have to decide individual rights. And what the legislature has said is they're different than city councils and they're different than school boards as in news press. They can consult behind closed doors with council. They can communicate confidentially with council. But if you're quasi-legislative, you're like a court. And worse, you can't even deliberate behind closed doors as this court can. And that's your decision from Hodge. So this is not going to be a broad problem. I do believe, on the flip side, the problems, if this court were to rule against GPS, could be quite significant. Because this is a template. This would be a template to all governmental bodies. It would say it doesn't matter if the legislature said everything's open. It doesn't matter if the Supreme Court said in Hodge deliberations have to be open. All you got to do is do everything in writing. If you have a question, a concern, put it in writing to your attorney. Have him respond in writing. Never have the attorney show up. Don't say a word at any of your meetings, at any of your hearings on these on somebody's property rights. And there it is. So it would that, I think, would be a broader problem than the one that I don't think would exist, but that was pointed out as a potential by the amicus parties.
What worries, and this is just another way of phrasing Justice Crooks's issue, as lawyers, our initial reaction is, of course, attorney-client communications are privileged, right? That's the initial reaction.
Correct.
And then you get to the point where you say, well, is there anything that this board can do with a lawyer that you're not entitled to know?
Well, as I indicated before, Chief Justice, absolutely, if this board is involved in actual
litigation. Okay, short of litigation.
Well, and again,
by the way, every particular variance claim is potentially involved in litigation. That's why you're here.
That's correct, but I see my time is up. May I briefly answer? That's correct, Your Honor, but it's not an adversarial type of litigation. Whether it's in front of the board itself, it's clearly non-adversarial, but even if their decision is challenged, it's not the board really being sued. It's the decision, whether that decision was appropriate under the rules that are in place and under the facts in the case. And so it's not your standard type of litigation, but certainly outside of the litigation context, as I discussed earlier, I think there are probably records that are not official actions of the board, that are not the board's examinations. And I mentioned an example, and there may be others. Justice Wilcox and Justice Crooks, I believe, asked the question about, well, what if we're in a different setting? What if they're not doing one of those statutory duties that they have, if it's in between time, for example? And I guess the answer is that the statute is not quite as clear about that. But I think the policy is the same. In between variance requests, if they were to ask Mr. O'Connor, hey, we heard about a new case that came down. Can you describe that for us? Again, what's the point of not letting the public, including potential requesters of variances, find out what the state of the law is in the board's counsel's mind? So I think the answer is that the context shouldn't change things dramatically, but it's not quite as clear under the statute.
Okay,
we ask the court to reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals and to order the board to make the records at issue public. And thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Friedman. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. O'Connor.
If it pleases the court, my name is William O'Connor. I am here today with my associate, Mary Beth Peranto, representing the town of St. Germain. Also in the courtroom is Mr. Jim Wendt, who is the present chairman of the board of the town of St. Germain. I want to clear up a couple of points on factual issues that were discussed by counsel in his opening remarks and also included in the court summary. There was one public hearing in this case. The second meeting that was held was not a hearing. That was a decision meeting. At that decision hearing, it was not noticed as a public hearing. No testimony was taken. At that decision hearing, the board did not review the packet of materials, as is stated in the court's description of this case and in counsel's brief. The board at that decision hearing reviewed only the findings of fact, conclusions of law, and order that had been proposed by the town board chairman, who moved action on that at that meeting. This case comes down to the construction of two statutory provisions, one in the open records law, the other in the zoning law. Council shifts back and forth regularly between those two statutes, picking and choosing provisions of each that best suit his argument. The open records law clearly includes an exemption for common law substantive principles, which this Court has recognized to include attorney-client privileged communications. By contrast, Section 62237, the provision of the subsection of the municipal law that establishes the Board of Appeals at issue here, is a part of a 1922 law that was written by eminent landscape architect Oliver Homestead and other engineers and planning experts back when Herbert Hoover was the Secretary of the United States Department of Commerce, serving on an advisory committee. We're now receiving an argument from counsel that that nearly some 80-year-old law had the consequence of annulling the attorney-client privilege as that pertains to a certain body of local governments.
Counselor, can you answer why do you want to keep these records secret? I mean, why don't you want the person who's subject to the board's decision to understand why the board made its decision? I mean, whether they like it or not, they would certainly feel they had a fairer shake, wouldn't they? Why do you want to keep them secret?
Well, of course, Justice Rogensack, the decision that was made by the board was reflected in the decision and order that was approved by the Board of Appeal.
That doesn't
stated the specific basis. That stated the specific basis under the precedence of this court for determining when a variance is warranted, the factual basis for the decision and the evaluation that the board made, and its decision.
I understand that, but that didn't answer my question. My question is, why do you want to keep secret the standards council told the board to apply when they agreed to accept those findings and conclusions?
As you know, Justice Rogensack, the privilege belongs not to counsel, but to the client.
I would urge
the court, in considering the question of whether these documents are privileged, to recognize that due to the form of this action, what the court sees of these interactions are these few documents. By contesting those under the open records law, that's the limit of the scope of the information and evidence the court has about those relations. But, of course, those records don't exist in isolation. They constitute a portion of communications between the board chair and counsel that included telephone conversations and other matters that would give a scope and a clearer understanding of these issues. But those are not before the court, and I think it would be a violation of my obligations if I disclosed those communications as well.
No, when I say you, Counselor, I mean your client. I mean, you're not here before me personally. You're here before me to assist your clients. My concern is, why doesn't the board want to let people know the standards they applied and the basis they had for making those findings and conclusions? I'm a little puzzled by that.
I think the board believed that it did make those standards available to people and did permit the applicant to know precisely what the grounds were for the decision that was made and what standard they were using.
With all due respect, Counselor, I reviewed what was in the folder, and they're quite different from what you did release. What is in there is quite different. I mean, so anyway, that's fine. Thank you.
Counsel, you were clearing up some factual discrepancies or issues, and it was my understanding, I'm just looking at the brief here, that first of all, there was a meeting on December 15, 1999 to address the variance, and that a day prior to that, you sent the board a document setting forth the standards for considering the variance request. Okay, is that correct or not so far?
I believe that's correct.
Okay. What you said, and then at the December 15th meeting, which was the first of two meetings, you had the one on December, that the, just so I understand, that there was another meeting. The first regarded the variance request. The board heard GPS and the others interested in this variance. And then they scheduled a second meeting, and that was on January 10th, 2000. So far, I've got it correct, right?
That's correct, John.
And then 3 days before that meeting, you allegedly sent a packet of material to the board chairman, which included a letter explaining the procedures, which included drafts of the motion to allegedly deny, I guess, the GPS variance, a notice of the board's decision denying the variance, and along with the findings of fact and the conclusions of law that you referred to, and a decision and an order. So now, at that January 10th meeting, as I understand the facts, the board silently reviewed the material. Nothing was said, and then denied the request. Is that right or wrong?
The record indicates that what they reviewed was limited to the proposed order, the findings of fact, conclusions of law, and order, not the other materials that were sent in this so-called packet.
Okay, so.
And it is correct, as I understand the facts, that the board did not discuss aloud the matters that were addressed in their order.
So this was known as the silent meeting. This was a meeting where the board came and the petitioner's GPS were there, but nothing was said.
I believe what was said was that a motion was made and seconded to approve the action as it was prepared and proposed for the board's consideration by the chairman.
Now, just we're looking at all the tension between the open meeting and the attorney-client privilege. What I'm just thinking about is that there's something seems to be unfair about that. If a litigant or a in this case, it's a quasi-judicial hearing. Someone comes there, they expect to hear some reasons. Do you think that that's the proper way to proceed?
Your Honor, I think it is fully suitable for an attorney on the request of a client to prepare a proposed action for that client where he or she is in a position such as the chairman of the board to offer. As to whether it was appropriate for the board to conduct its deliberations by silent reading and acceptance, I think that raises a question which could have been raised in a certiorari case, but was not. But I don't think that form of deliberation and whether it accorded the applicant due process is something that can be raised by, for whatever reason, not bringing a certiorari review action, and then to bring a public records action and bootstrap the lost opportunity to challenge that. I don't believe that I need to defend that.
So you're saying they
I don't think it's before the court.
Yeah, you're saying they waived it because they didn't. All right.
I think the court has previously ruled that Section 6223 sub 10 is jurisdictional, that if you do not timely commence a review, you have lost your opportunity to do that, and it's jurisdictional in the court.
Counsel, let's assume that your motives are pure, as it's easy to assume.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Watch out now.
But let's say there's some other person. Not clearly not you, who doesn't have those same pure motives. Someone, as the Newspaper Association brief advances, that really uses this formula, as they say, for a template for secrecy, really trying to get around the governmental responsibility for open meetings. In that instance, would the deliberating body have a reasonable expectation of confidentiality?
Justice Bradley, I don't see how the threatened system would work. What is involved in this case is communication between counsel and a single member of the board, and the development of a proposed action by that single member of the board. There is absolutely no evidence in this case that there was any interaction between or among members of the board in advance of this meeting.
Okay, but
there
what about
no evidence of it at all.
What about my hypothetical question?
Your hypothetical would only work, in my view, if there had been such interaction, which would, I believe, have clearly been a violation of the open meeting law.
So the
in
response
this case,
is if a procedure or technique in writing back and forth with counsel is used to circumvent the open meeting law, then it's your position that there would be no reasonable expectation of confidentiality, ergo no privilege would exist.
I think if there were the kind of communications that were among members of the board and counsel, that those could constitute a species of deliberation. But that interaction between a single member of the board and an attorney's preparation of a proposed action to be introduced for consideration by that single member, I don't think can constitute such a conspiracy.
It can. I mean, my question is not whether or not it constitutes a deliberation, but when one is intentionally trying to circumvent, when the efforts are made to circumvent open meetings law by employing this technique, is that privileged, more specifically? Is there a reasonable expectation of confidentiality?
I believe that if a member of such a board seeks the assistance of counsel in preparing a motion or an action, that that is a situation in which the official requesting that has an expectation of confidentiality.
Is there a reason? I could ask my question one more time, but I won't, I guess.
Question. So Ms. A asks you for, would you prepare a motion? Because this is what I want. And would you prepare findings of fact and conclusions of law for me? Because I'm going to persuade the board to go the way I do it. The next day, Mr. Z, member of the board, calls and says, I want you to prepare a motion. It's exactly the opposite of Ms. A. And I want you to prepare findings of fact, conclusions of law, because I think the board's going to go with me. You'd prepare both?
I think so, Your Honor.
And send them each both. And your position is that they don't, as a board, discuss that with each other or with you, but you're just dealing with them separately, okay? Now, right?
Yes.
Okay. With all due respect to attorneys and with all due respect to your knowledge in the area, you might have a very, very experienced town clerk who happens to be very interested in the invariances and follows this. We all know non-lawyers who are very expert in a small or large area of the law, right? All right. So we have now a town clerk who is performing the same services. The board chair calls him or her and says, here's what I want, Joe. Think you can draft it? And Joe says, yeah, I drafted a million of them. And then Ms. Z does the same thing. Would that be privileged? It's not an attorney. Would he be let's get away from whether he's practicing law. But he's drafting a motion. Just jillions of people draft motions for everything. Okay? And findings of fact and conclusions, which is not very legalistic. So, would that be protected?
I think they could be protected as drafts under the open meetings law. The open records law expressly exempts from the records that are available for public inspection drafts. And it also exempts documents that are prepared by one person for another.
So is that what you're claiming?
That may be applicable to this. I think that exemption may be applicable to some of the documents that are in the closed record. I think others are clearly attorney-client privileged communications.
And your client is any one member of the board rather than the board as a whole? And if so, then how can you represent them all when they have conflicting views?
I think that my client is the Board of Appeal.
Right.
And I think that within the scope of authority of the Board of Appeal and the way that it establishes its own rules for its operations, which are expressly authorized by the statute, that they may permit their chairman to interact with counsel to obtain legal advice on matters that are pending before the board.
What about a motion that the chair wants? That was one of the things drafted, right?
I understand that isn't a closed record.
Right. So you
and I believe that would be within the scope of that authority
under giving
of the board chair.
Okay.
O'Connor, the procedures that were followed in this matter, are they typical?
No, I don't believe they are, Your Honor. I think that what happened with respect to the meeting at which the proposed action was considered in silence was an extremely unusual manner of procedure for the Board of Appeal.
Well, is your procedure in advising them and drafting various documents that they can then use, is that the usual way they do business?
At the time that these events occurred, I was asked to prepare findings of fact, conclusions of law and order for the first time for the town. The town's zoning program had not routinely used those kinds of decision narratives in the past, but there were significant changes that were being made in this period of time by the town of St. Germain in the way that it handled its zoning program. And so in this particular case, I drafted findings of fact, conclusions of law and order in two separate variances that were simultaneously pending before the board, both of which involved what have been described as dimensional variances, and both of which raised vexing and potentially litigation-generating issues that perhaps the court may understand from the difficulty the court itself has had in discerning the meaning of the authority to grant variances.
Counselor, I'm looking at the memorandum you prepared, dated December 14, 1999. It says it was sent to the whole board. Do you know, was it used by the board?
I have no knowledge of that.
Okay. And was it sent, did you send it just to the board chairman, or did you
Yes.
send copies to everyone?
No, I sent, my correspondence was with the chairman of the Board of Appeals.
All right. So you have no idea whether this got distributed to the board and they used it or not?
The only information that I have is in the decision of the trial court that indicates that what the board reviewed was the proposed order.
Did the trial court specifically say to your recollection that the board never reviewed your December 14th memorandum?
There was no fact-finding to determine that. This was a public records case in which the question was, are these records protected? GPS took the position that the attorney-client privilege is trumped by the open records law.
Counselor, you know, just let's do a hypothetical. Let's just say the board reviewed your memorandum. They don't know a lot about the law, and they wanted to know what they were supposed to do in this circumstance with a request for a variance. So say they reviewed it, and that was part of what they were thinking about when they were hearing the facts from these folks that came in for requested variances. If someone wanted to challenge the board's decision on certiorari, how could they do it if they didn't know what the standards were the board was considering for the factors that they were supposed to be applying to come to a conclusion?
Well, unlike most certiorari cases, Your Honor, the specific version of certiorari that's provided under the zoning law permits the court, in a proper case where it's in the interest of justice, to take additional evidence. And so if they felt, as they argued in their earlier briefs in the Court of Appeals, that the reasons that were outlined in the decision and order were not the so-called real reasons, they could have gone behind that by conducting an evidentiary proceeding before the circuit court.
Well, that may well be so, but how would they know whether they should challenge the reasons or not if they didn't know what the reasons were, except for what's written in the findings?
I don't think that there is any basis to believe that there were reasons other than those that the chairman of the board proposed in that order and that the members accepted.
Well,
the idea that there are other reasons is something that is the creation of the litigants.
Well, yes and no, Counselor. I mean, your memo is significantly broader than what's in the findings. So if they read it, they might have had some other reasons in mind. Now, if they didn't read it, then it probably doesn't make a heck of a lot of difference. So, when you look at certiorari, it's such a limited review, and I understand there are times when you can expand that a bit. But, basically, if you're going to determine whether the board acted according to law, you got to know what law they thought they were supposed to be applying. And that goes back to my first question of, why did you want to keep these secret if you want the process to follow through on the standard format? I don't get it.
I guess all I can offer, Your Honor, is that this is a situation where certiorari is not so limited, and that the determination as to which records the town would invoke the attorney-client privilege is a decision not for me.
Just for clarification, Chief, may I? As I recall the law with regard to cert, that this is not at the party's instance. However, if the court deems it appropriate, the court can allow additional testimony. But just because a party wants additional testimony, that certainly doesn't indicate that the court is going to broaden the rather normal restrictive parameters of cert. Is that correct or am I incorrect?
I don't believe that there's it's a matter of right for the challenger. But it is expressly authorized in this particular subsection of the statute.
The court can do it, yes.
Yes.
That was a long 12.5, Mr. Not your fault.
I had thought my watch wasn't working properly, but thank you.
Thank you, Mr. O'Connor. William F. White, Michael Best and Friedrich representing the Administrative and Local Government section of the Wisconsin Bar Association.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. With me today also is Brian Ryberick, an associate in the firm who did the laboring oar in drafting this brief, and also Michael Morse, who is the chair of the local, the administrative and local government section. I start with a disclaimer. We do not speak for the State Bar Association, but only for the section. And if you think it's hard getting to this body, try to get through the Board of Governors to file an amicus brief. It's something. Let me tell you why we got interested and what kind of got us excited about this, and maybe I don't have to be quite as excited. First of all, we read the GPS position to be to do away altogether with the attorney-client privilege in the context of variance appeals. Now, I think I understood that that isn't the case, that in fact there could be some exceptions to that, and I would certainly urge the court, should they find specifically on specific documents, as Justice Rogensack is pointing out may or may not be privileged, that there still exists the privilege. The second thing that got us excited was what I'll call the legal moonwalk that's going on here, which is we seem to be walking toward open records, but we're going backwards into certiorari. And if you read the petitioner's brief, it is peppered throughout with concerns about process and who said what and what was the real motive and how can we get behind the decision. That's not before the court. That it quite simply is not what's at issue today. And we take great offense on behalf of local government bodies to the efforts of a dissatisfied petitioner who either negligently or intentionally did not file timely a certiorari action, coming back and ending up in the Supreme Court on a matter which is guised as open records but is actually a disguised certiorari. We are, in fact,
Mr. White,
if I
might ask you a question that's been giving me some pause, at least. Let's say that you're an attorney representing the Board of Zoning Appeals for Town X, and one of the members of the board at an open meeting where you're going to consider variances says to you, would you explain to us, counsel, what that Wisconsin Supreme Court just did in their decision in Kenosha County.
would you feel that you would have to go into a private confidential session to answer that question, or would you answer it in an open fashion?
If I were asked to describe the case, that's correct. If I was asked to analyze the implications depending on different factual findings, I would prefer to be in closed session.
So you feel that, for instance, the correspondence that went back and forth here with counsel and the board chair would be another way of appropriately maintaining confidence?
I am slightly disadvantaged in not having actually seen these documents, and I've tried to discern through the...
Assume that that basically there's some kind of back and forth about what does this new case mean and how should it be applied.
I believe that it is an appropriate, and I don't know the nature of the communications, but I have in my practice been asked, well, if this, then what? How do we handle this? And this court is more than keenly aware of the unsettled nature of the variance standards, depending on where you're located and what kinds of standards to apply. There's another matter which I think I heard this wasn't a due process case, yet throughout the brief in chief, we see Maris that's brought out. I call Maris the one false move case. We'll get you into trouble. And quite frankly, we have a situation where we demand of our governing boards, people of common sense and everyday experience coming in to adjudicate vital property interests. They often are unsophisticated. They're not lawyers, usually not, and yet we ask of them a very high standard of due process. And I think in those circumstances, we are all well advised for them to be well advised in terms of what is appropriate or not. I was interested that the scribblings would not be available for review, yet what if those scribblings talked about the applicant as being, let's say, Leona Helmsley? What would that do to the due process aspects of a particular case?
Well, I'd like to be clear as to where you draw the line. You'd say, as I understood your answer, that if it was just a general discussion of case law, that would occur in open session. But that if it was going to relate to a particular request for variance and how that case or cases would apply, you'd feel that should be in a closed session?
In my opinion, yes, Your Honor.
And on what do you base that, on 90503?
I would base it on common sense that as you change the kaleidoscope of a factual situation, you can come out with different results. And so if a member of the board said, well, if we found that the road was bumpy, would that still be the same result? And I could say, you know, either yes or no, but you may want to consider other facts, and depending, it's the entire nature of a confidential communication between attorney and client. I want to make one other very important point before I get to red. We seem to be acting like we're writing on a blank slate about the attorney-client privilege, and I just want to highlight for the court, we may have had an open meetings law in the 62.23 since 1941. Attorney-client privilege has been since the mid-1500s, as in the Stetson Law Review article cited in our brief. The privilege itself is embodied in the Open Records Law, 19.35 sub 1 sub A, where it clearly says that you refer back to common law privilege, that nothing is abrogating a common law privilege. We go to the Open Meetings Law, 19.85 sub 1 sub G, where they can retreat into closed session if there's pending or threatened litigation. It is my understanding that the threat may have been available in this particular case.
Counselor, let me just interrupt you for a minute.
Yes, Justice.
As you probably guessed from my questions, my concern is whether these documents are confidential documents, because I don't think that everything an attorney gives to a client is confidential.
Right.
And I think that anybody that practices law for a while knows that sometimes you make things to give to clients, and later on you decide to disclose them, and of course they lose their confidentiality at that point.
The client must disclose it.
Exactly. Yeah, right. When I say you, I only mean
that's
clients.
Right.
So I'm not, you're not here personally.
Right. Thank you.
Okay. And my concern is how, if that's the standard, given the obligations of the board under Chapter 62 to conduct
their deliberations and their deciding processes pretty much in the light for all to see.
Right.
How do we evaluate the documents that we have before us?
On a case-by-case basis?
Document by document.
Document by document. That's the way we do it. There's nothing in the facts of this case which would indicate a wholesale nature to override what is the legislative intent, which is clearly to preserve the attorney-client privilege available to all public bodies, including zoning boards of appeals in appropriate circumstances. We believe it is a narrow exception, but it is an exception nonetheless. We read the circuit court's decision as saying it's narrow. We rely, quite frankly, on the Court of Appeals in-camera review of these documents and finding them to be attorney-client privilege. If Your Honors disagree with your Court of Appeals, that's what you're there to do. But from my point of view, the law of this case is that these are privileged documents, and there's nothing compelling to do a wholesale eradication of the attorney-client privilege.
So it's your position that you start out and you look at the first document, and it's attorney-client privilege unless there's something that changes that privilege.
If
these are communications back and forth between lawyer and client.
Communications back and forth which discuss the legal rights of the client, which are intended to be confidential and are maintained as confidential. Then I think the appropriate second-guessing is through an in-camera review by a judicial officer.
Well, does the statute, you know, what I intend in a particular circumstance can be changed by statute, right?
Correct.
Okay. So does Chapter 62 have any effect on the, quote, intent of the board to keep these documents confidential?
No. And I say that for two reasons, one of which is you look at the description of the public documents, minutes, examinations, undefined, and official actions. Mm-hmm. What we're looking at here are the underlying documents to any of those three, and so we're going over to Chapter 19. And that was the second reason, but it completely lost me at this
okay.
point.
Okay, all right, thank you.
Can I ask you, Mr. White, what is your view on how typical the procedure followed in this matter is, if you look statewide?
I don't know the answer to that. Oftentimes in a situation, personally, I feel boards are well advised to get advice. You send the advice off, you label it as attorney-client privilege because that is your job, is to start out with that. It is the client's to waive. Should they get those documents, distribute them, look at them, and whatever is there, make their own agreement, that can certainly happen. We could tell a few war stories, but as I do quite a bit of work in this area, not only on the government side, but also on the applicant side of things. And you can go around this state and see a whole wide variety of how different boards will treat their decision-making authority. And so I would say that it wouldn't surprise me that this would happen, but I doubt that you would find this, you know, let's not talk about it, written in a procedure manual, if you will. I would also take one exception on the Hodge characterization. I think Hodge is carefully limited to the one exception to the closed meeting, which is for deliberations. And I think Justice Bablich in that case found that there was no indicia of sworn witnesses, cross-examination, some authentication of documents, anything that would take the quasi-judicial body and translate it to the quasi-judicial proceeding. But I do not think this court did a wholesale statement that the attorney-client privilege may never be invoked for a ZBA under Hodge.
Are particular communications with particular members of the board within attorney-client? Who's the client here?
Well, I don't know in this case. I can tell you two things. The 90503 says public officer and public bodies, so clearly both are encompassed. All public bodies, when they hire attorneys, will usually say you can only deal with one person so that you're not responding to the five different people. It's very common to be dealing with the chairman or the chair of a particular body. You send it to them. It's up to them to distribute or not, or to chat, or however they do it. But I believe that when you're dealing with the chair, you're dealing with the client.
So if I was just a member of the body and asked you for a memo or asked you for a proposal or asked you for your opinion, you wouldn't give it to me?
I would check with the chair.
How do you handle that when you've got the chair and the members on opposite sides? I'm just trying to think.
Well, it's a very good question, and this is part of the art of the lawyer's craft, is to understand who binds, who has authority, and oftentimes you do get yourself a little whipsawed there.
You know, as an attorney, I used to represent school boards.
There you go. Yeah.
You know that there was often differing opinions, and I'm just wondering how you would handle it in this situation.
Well, I'm tempted to say very carefully. But it is. I mean, it's part of what we want out of our system, is to have people of different viewpoints come to, especially where you have not one decision maker, but three or five or seven or more.
And they each have their own lawyer?
Sometimes they do. Sometimes they do.
And the town pays for
it. I don't know that. But, if the town chooses to, the town will. I've dealt with individual counsel of individual board members, and my job is, as I see it, is to represent all of them to the extent that I possibly can. And, you don't take sides within those situations, but try to walk down the middle.
Counsel, any other questions? Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. White. Mr. Norting?
May it please the Court, my name is Richard Norting. I'm with the Stafford Rosenbaum Law Firm. I'm here today representing the Wisconsin Counties Association and the Wisconsin Towns Association. I'm also authorized to state that my remarks, in addition, are on behalf of the League of Wisconsin Municipalities. So in short, I speak on behalf of local government and local government officials across the state of Wisconsin. In other words, with regard to the attorney-client privilege issue that is before the court here, I'm speaking from the client perspective. And these clients, towns, counties, cities, and villages, are very concerned about this case because we believe that if this court accepts and buys the rationale that's being offered by GPS, the result will be no meaningful attorney-client privilege for governmental bodies all around the state.
How do you read the rationale? What do you think they're asking for, Mr. Norting?
Well, the rationale seems to be that there is a special mandate in the zoning statute for extra openness and extra transparency above and beyond what is called for in the open meetings law and in the public records law. And our view is that the language in the zoning statute is not special or unique, and it does not have any mandate for extra openness. They rely on two statements in the zoning statute for their position. The first statement is the statement that all meetings of the board shall be open to the public. The second statement is that certain documents, and in this instance specifically records of the board's official actions, quote, shall be a public record, close quote. Those are the two statements they rely on for the so-called special mandate. Well, let's look, first of all, at that second statement. Statement is, certain documents shall be a public record. What follows from that? To me, what follows from that is, therefore, they are subject to handling in accordance with our state's comprehensive public records law. What follows from the GPS line of reasoning, though, is, because a certain thing is stated to be a public record, therefore, there's an intention by the legislature to say there must be absolute disclosure of these documents, overriding our general public records law and overriding the attorney-client privilege, which has been maintained by the legislature in the comprehensive open records, a public records law.
What's the point of the attorney-client privilege? I thought it was so that somebody who needed legal advice would tell the full truth to a lawyer, knowing that that communication would not be revealed, and that the lawyer could then give advice, and whether it was revealed or not was up to the client. How does that fit with a public body?
I think it fits very well.
Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe that's
well. No, I believe you have stated. Okay. I believe you have stated the purpose. Although I think I would state it just slightly differently. I think that the policy behind it is to encourage the freest possible flow of information between the client and the attorney, so that the attorney is in a position to give the client the best possible advice.
Okay.
But I see no difference with a public body or with a public official, because if the communication is not going to be privileged, there will be a chilling effect on the flow of communications from the client to the lawyer. We don't want our public officials around the state having to, any time they sit down to talk about a problem with a lawyer, we don't want those public officials asking themselves, well, can I ask this? Should I say that? How is it going to look if there's a public display of that I asked this question? The communications, let me put it this way. From a question was asked during one of the prior arguments, why would it be important that that some communications be kept secret? From a client perspective, speaking now on behalf of local governmental bodies and local officials, I think the answer is, if my lawyer writes simply an arid statement of the law, you know, as he might put into a law review article, I don't care if that's public or not, and I wouldn't have any problem in the lawyer, you know, stating aloud at a meeting or distributing to the public at large, you know, this is the general state of the law on the subject matter that we are dealing with. But if we are dealing with a communication which either directly or inferentially will reveal what my questions of the lawyer were, what my concerns were, what I was asking the lawyer about, then I do not want that to be public, because I do not want there to be a chilling effect on me or any of the other public officials on how they deal with their lawyers.
No, I understand what, and I understand the concern. What maybe we're talking a little, and this is might be an unfair question to you, but under this procedure, what took place here in this case, there's something that just doesn't seem right to me. I mean, that is what I think, that when you have this openness, this transparency that's supposedly given to you by the statute, and then you have these communications, and then you have the conclusions drafted, and then you have silence at a meeting, is there any way, I guess that's what, I understand meeting with the attorney, I understand that, but in this case, that isn't what happened.
And I understand your concern, and I would say the thing about it that appears to be troubling, I think, is that the board members sit there, they read the proposed motion, and they don't say a word, they just adopt it, and all of a sudden everybody's suspicious. Well, there must be something going on here that isn't right. But I don't think that's necessarily true. But if it were true, then certiorari is the way to get at that. But I don't think it's necessarily true. Suppose the chairman were himself or herself a lawyer, and we get done with the hearing, and the chairman says, let's take a 5-minute recess so we can have a potty break and so forth, and I'm going to sit down and write up a motion because I have a proposed motion for our board. And so there's a 5 or 10 minute recess. The chairman writes up his own motion, proposed findings, conclusions, and order. And when the people come back, he says, all right, here's my motion. And the members are all sitting there now. They're free, just as they were here, to agree or disagree with the motion, to discuss the motion. But there's no mandate that they absolutely have to talk about the motion, I don't think. If there is a legal requirement to that effect, it would be a matter of whether there was proper process or due process. That would be a certiorari question. But it doesn't affect whether there was attorney-client communications here. What difference would it make if instead of drafting his own motion, the chairman says, let's take a 5-minute recess, I'm going to call our lawyer and get him to help me draft a motion? That's basically what happened here. I don't see anything wrong with it, really.
You know, that's one of the things that bothers me, in that I keep thinking it's the board that makes the decisions.
Right.
The board is supposed to discuss it in public, reach a conclusion. Seems to me the board ought to have the benefit of legal advice as to the state of the law. Yeah, unless one of them's a lawyer or very learned, which can be, you might need help as to, I think somebody on the court said, what's the most recent decisions in this area. Might use Wisconsin Municipality, legal municipality that puts out publications that tell you what's the state of the law, written by one of your lawyers, or the county association in their publication. So they've got that, or they get it. But after that, I'm troubled as to how much they have to do themselves, so that it's their decision and their deliberations.
I understand. And if this is a question that would have been a pretty interesting question to have been brought by certiorari. Was there some failure of process here for a lack of open discussion on the part of the board? But that's not the case we have. The case we have asks a much narrower question. It simply asks, are these communications, these correspondence between the chairman and the attorney, and I'm assuming as well that this court on in-camera review would find, as the Court of Appeals did, that they are within the scope of attorney-client privileged communications, assuming that they are, must they nonetheless be disclosed? I see nothing in the zoning statute that can be viewed as an attempt by the legislature to trump the attorney-client privilege or to trump the general rules of our comprehensive public records law. And I would refer the court to, in my final comment here, I would refer the court to the brief of the League of Municipalities, because there they point out that this so-called special mandate in the zoning statute is not special at all. Language virtually identical to what the GPS and its allies are relying on applies to village boards of trustees generally, applies to common councils generally, and it shows up beginning on page 4 of the League's brief, where they cite section 61.32 of the statutes that provides all meetings shall be open to the public. Speaking about now about village boards of trustees. It's the very same thing that they are relying on here to say there's a special mandate of openness that's going to override the public records law and the attorney-client privilege that is incorporated in that law. And later on in that same statute, it says that the proceedings of the board shall be published and shall include the substance of every official action taken by a governing body. The very same kind of pronouncement that's in the zoning statute. And on the next page of the brief, a similar language as it pertains to common councils. This is why we are so concerned. There's no special mandate in the Zoning Board of Appeals statute. The language that appears there appears relative to village boards of trustees generally, to common councils generally. Are we to conclude from that the public records law is not going to govern the records of those agencies, that the attorney-client privilege is not going to apply to common councils and village boards because there's been this special mandate of openness and transparency? I don't think so. I think that argument leads us way too far. I think the bottom line is they do not accept the public policy decision that our legislature has made to grant the same attorney-client privilege to public bodies as exists for private clients.
You're referring to the rules of evidence?
No, I'm referring to page 5 of the newspaper's brief, where they describe what they think the attorney-client privilege should be for governmental bodies. And it's not the attorney-client privilege that we have. It would be a very limited and qualified attorney-client privilege. It would be one where, in order to invoke it, you have to demonstrate a special need for confidentiality. Nobody else has to make some special demonstration of need in order to invoke the attorney-client privilege. And if you need to, if you have to make that kind of a showing in order to rely on the privilege, I submit the privilege is largely useless, because now you're always concerned, you know, you can't rely on it. You can't rely on it.
Thank you, Mr. Norton. Friedman, you get the last word.
Thank you, Chief Justice. I'd like to make a few brief points in rebuttal. First, the statute at issue here is special. The mandate is special. And Mr. Norton wanted to gloss over the differences. None of the other statutes mention the examinations. None of the other bodies he discussed are quasi-judicial. None of the other bodies he discussed have a ruling like Hodge that essentially says none of the open meetings exceptions apply, that the deliberations have to be done in public. Second, I'd like to go back to something that Justice Rogensack has been asking a lot of questions about, and that is the idea of certiorari review in this case, and what are we getting at here versus what you could get in certiorari review. What's critical is that the open records law and the statute governing town zoning board of appeals at issue in this case are for the public. The public has a right to see what's going on in these proceedings. The public can't bring a certiorari review. So in this particular case, it happens to be GPS. If it were a newspaper, if it were a member of the public, certiorari is not an option. They can't look behind the scenes. And that's absolutely a critical distinction in this case. Now, Justice Crooks asked Mr. White, well, what if you were in the audience at the meeting and they asked for a general recitation of the law? And he said, well, that I do in open session. Justice Crooks went a step further and said, well, what if they wanted an application of the law to the facts? And Mr. White said, well, then I'd want to go into closed session. Problem is, they can't. This court said that in Hodge. They can't go into closed session with their attorney. Chapter 62 says that must be open. All meetings must be open to the public. Chapter 19, subsection with the 19.81 in there, says all meetings are public except for the very limited exceptions in 19.85 sub 1. And in Hodge, this court said none of those apply. So you can't go into closed session. And that's our point here. They should get counsel, legal counsel, on these difficult topics. There's no question. But why can't the public, why can't the applicant in this case know what the law is, what facts they're relying on? And I think it's particularly critical in this case, as a few of the members of the court have pointed out, we don't know who really made the decision, thumbs up or thumbs down. We know that Mr. O'Connor drafted the order and the proposed findings and the notice. We know the board voted on them, but there was only one set, as far as we know, a set that said, vote thumbs down. We don't know if Chairman Sharon went to Mr. O'Connor and said, prepare something that says, vote thumbs down. We don't know if the board somehow communicated with each other and said, hey, should we vote up or down on this variance request? We don't know who made the decision. Don't you think that the public and GPS has a right to know who decided that the only packet that would be presented to the board that day would say, no, your variance request is denied? We don't know anything about what happened. We're not challenging the process. We're trying to figure out what it is. And for that reason, we ask the court to reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals and to order these records open to the public.
Counsel, let me ask you a question. To say I agree with everything you said today, and I think that these records should be given to you, and I say, fine, okay, we're ordering these records. For whatever reason, they're no longer protected by attorney-client privilege. How's that going to help your client? They're not going to get their variance because the time's gone by for them to complain about the denial.
It's going to give them peace of mind, Your Honor. It's going to let them see what actually happened in this case, whether they were railroaded. They just don't know. I mean, the court knows, and I know, because I was able to see the records as well, pursuant to a provision in the open records law. But they don't know. They don't know if this was a fair process. And that's critical for a board with these types of powers, quasi-judicial powers affecting personal rights of individuals. They have to... Everyone has to presume and has to be able to believe that they're acting in a fair manner. And my clients just don't know. And the fact that they are so zealously guarding these records, I can only imagine what my clients are thinking about that.
Thank you. Any further questions?
Well, thank you, counsel. And before I close it, I do want to recognize that Sandra George, who is with the Wisconsin Newspaper Association, is here. And although we don't, and I personally don't take the Wisconsin Newspaper Association's brief per se as great, I do take Sandra George's great. And she's leaving the state, or at least the Wisconsin Newspaper Association, and I did want to recognize you, Ms. George. So with that recognition, we'll close the hearing on 02-3293, GPS, Inc. versus Town of St. Germain. And thank all the council, not only for a vigorous and good argument, but their staying power. That closes it. We are back in session at 1:30.